When I was a kid, I used to think a lot about the improbability of my existence. Did you ever do this? You know, like, what are the chances that I was born? What are the chances that these were my parents? What are the chances I was born in this country? And back before I knew how babies were made, I kind of just assumed I would be born somewhere. And I just happened to be born in Canada with my parents, with my sister coming soon. But then I learned about how babies were made, and that was pretty mind-blowing, right? And I learned, like, statistically, my existence, minuscule. I mean, millions of swimmers trying to find their way, millions of moments, lots of factors is what I'm trying to say, all of which would have decided whether I was born or not, where I would exist. And I kind of was taken by this fact. I was, well, overwhelmed by the reality of this lottery that I seemed to have won. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I was born in like the best time in the world to be born. And most of the time this had to do with like computers. Because I was born around the time in which personal computers became a thing. I grew up with the internet of a globalized world. I remember being a kid chatting to people in other countries, and I was like, wow, every other generation before me would never have experienced this. This is the best time to exist. We can get on a plane and go across the world. We put someone on the moon. We have a space station. I mean, it's just incredible to think about what we've accomplished in this moment. Now, as I grew older and I watched the evolution of technology, I started to feel a little bit regretful. I was like, okay, so I had to be born when dial-up was created instead of when broadband was created. Maybe it would have been better to be born in broadband, so I'd have to skip that annoying noise and having to fight for the phone line. I was born the year the Hubble telescope was launched. The year Mandela walked free in South Africa, the year Perestroika rang out, the year we began mapping the human genome. And I was born in Canada, in a prosperous place, to a family that had enough and more than enough money and food to meet my needs. I wasn't one of the 258 million malnourished children in the year of my birth. As I got older, I started to think about that. Think about that probability, the lottery that I won, which wasn't just about being born at all, being born at this moment, but it was about being born in a developed country, in a place where water wasn't a danger, where it was less likely that my mother would have died in childbirth. All of these things that seemed to be out of my control, these random factors that come to my existence, and I just felt deeply lucky, but it also seemed unfair, but I also seemed to get the better side of the bargain, so I kind of left it there, right? I didn't think till later about the unjust economic system that would allow my family to have more relative wealth than others in our city, about the unjust world economic system that would allow certain countries to be mired in poverty for generations, where mine had way more. I didn't think about, until I was taught about, the colonial system that allowed my parents, white Europeans, to arrive without barriers to Canada. I didn't know about all the ways my privilege opened doors for my existence. And it wasn't until later in college that I heard this story that really changed how I thought about this experience, how I transformed these thoughts of this lottery that I had won that seemed to be out of my control and nothing to the land on which I was born. I was born in Treaty 7, where in 1987, five Indigenous nations came together and signed a treaty with the Canadian government And it was a treaty that when you listen to the stories of the elders that passed down from that moment that it was made, it was a treaty in which these people said to these Europeans who are coming into their lands, as we cohabitate peacefully, I realized that this lottery that I won was not just a lottery in which I was given privilege, but in fact was a lottery in which I was given a deep responsibility. A deep responsibility to figure out my relationship to these people whom my country has oppressed since its beginning, but also my relationship to this future of this Canadian enterprise, this country. What is my responsibility to its history, to its present, and to its future? It is not something that I can or should escape, that I just didn't win the lottery of privilege. I won the lottery of responsibility too. Alicia Ford, a Unitarian Universalist minister, has these words. Am I a guest here in this house? Are you? Are we guests here in this house? And whose house do we inhabit? In the small world of our lives, the borders between us, easements, fences, gates, hedges, serve to delineate, to separate us, to remind us of where my property begins and ends, where your property begins and ends. And if you are a trespasser or a guest in my house, you've worked to own this small plot of land and the house erected upon it. You claim it. I claim it. It is now a part of myself, your definition of self. It is part of our identities. And so if I cross over your fence, I am a trespasser or I am a guest. What does it mean? She continues, that in 1845, the United States crossed over into Mexico and took half that country, took land, took resources, took labor. Were the U.S. trespassers? Guests? Are there to be no consequences for taking what does not belong to you? Should we simply forget whose home we inhabit? To speak of hospitality in immigration often erases historical context, she continues. The actions of the past that have led step by step to our current predicament erased. Progressor Miguel de la Torre, accurate to speak of the responsibility of restitution rather the virtue of hospitality. Hospitality in this case implies that the house, the country, the nation belongs to us, that the land, the resources that are a part of the house is ours, and we who live here are being virtuous when we're willing to share it. It erases the history that would have us remember that those who cross the border today, those choosing to brave the harsh conditions of the desert, those who face the possibility of death, deportation, criminalization, are doing so because the U.S. once crossed their borders to exact their resources and labor. It is for them a matter of survival. It is for the United States a matter of restitution. The prospect of restitution is scary because where do we begin? With Mexico? With Native Americans? With territories? With the descendants of those who were enslaved? How do we acknowledge and address the complexities of our history, present, and, if we're not conscious, future domination? What does right relationship look like? What conditions and considerations would make restitution possible? And for us, Unitarian Universalists, what would it mean for us to shake off the idea of hospitality as the central principle that is often attached to immigration and delve into the concept of restitution? Whose house do we inhabit? For we are not hosts. We are not owners, nor are we guests. What then is our responsibility? In the Hebrew Bible, in the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 33, it begins, "When a migrant resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress them. The migrant who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen among you. You shall love the migrant as yourself, for you were migrants in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. I brought you out of Egypt. Now, I've seen this quote a lot recently as we've been having these debates about immigration. And for a long time, I thought the most important part of that passage was the first bit. The most important part was the bit that said that we should not oppress the migrant, that those who reside in your land should be as citizens to you, that you should not maltreat them. I thought that was the most important part of the passage. But after encountering this work from Alicia Ford and Miguel de la Torre, it challenges this. It challenges this because I think the most important part of the passage is in fact the end of the passage in which God says, I brought you out of Egypt. Because if you'll remember the history of the Jewish people, they had to endure great hardships and exile from their homeland. And so in this passage, God is saying to them, remember. Remember the way you were treated. Remember the way you were enslaved. Remember the way when you were outside your land. So let your heart not harden, God is imploring, for I brought you out of Egypt. I brought you to freedom. I let you survive. I rained down plagues to set you free, to see you follow my commandments, to not become who enslaved you, but to be like that which set you free. When a foreigner resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress them. The foreigner who resides with you shall be as a citizen to you. You shall love the foreigner as yourself, for you were foreign in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. I brought you out of Egypt. We all got here somehow, each of us. Whether with the turtle that dove down to bring up the land, as the Arapaho tell, whether your ancestors were brought here by slavers, whether your relatives arrived here before 1882, the year the first foreign immigration laws were passed in the United States, whether your whiteness opened the doors, whether your color almost shutting borders, crossing cultures, we all got here somehow. When an illegal resides with you in your land, you shall not oppress them. The illegal who resides with you shall be to you a citizen among you. You shall love the illegal as yourself, for you were illegal in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. I brought you out of Egypt. The central question that I see in this pleading, I brought you out of Egypt, is not one for policymakers or those who cower in playing devil's advocates or acting the pragmatist. Because newsflash, acting justly is rarely pragmatic. The central question for the rest of us is to stare face first, eye to eye, with the travesty that is our current immigration system, and decide once and for all how we should answer the God of our understanding when we hear that phrase, I brought you out of Egypt to this place. What is your responsibility here? I brought you to freedom. Who shall you become? Shall you become like the people that thought their land was their own and so they enslaved you? Or should you become like that which set you free? What is our responsibility? In this country, we have a myopia around this migration story. A myopia about the ways in which the majority of white folks in this country came to this country through legal means or unregulated means. That we got here by virtue of our skin, and now when others try to do the same, we throw up questions and roadblocks and deportation forces. Did you know that the average Mexican citizen, if they were to apply to come and get a visa to live in the United States, would have to wait an average of 130 years? Those of us who were born in this country, those of us who were born in the West, won a lottery that is not without responsibility. We won a lottery of relationship, of responsibility and restitution to the relationships of those people who are here. Prior to 1882, with the passage of the Immigration Act, there was virtually no immigration enforcement in the United States. 1882. How many of you have ancestors who came to this country before 1882? There was no immigration enforcement before 1882. This act added layers of immigration enforcement, but only at certain ports of entry. And between 1891 and 1986, there was no systematic immigration enforcement in this country, at the border or within it. Outside of a few key ports of entry, there was no systematic enforcement of immigration laws. They had waves of immigration enforcement when fear of the other began to rise too great. We would muster troops and forces to carry out enforcement of the laws. One example is from 1926 to 1936, what is called the Mexican Repatriation. Do you know about this? From 1926 to 1936, between 400,000 and 2 million Mexican and Mexican Americans were deported from the United States. They were deported because they were blamed for the Depression. Once the Depression got deeper, upwards of 60% of those were American citizens of Mexican heritage. In fact, many of those people were living on Mexican land that had been Mexican far longer than it had been American, right? In 1970, to about the turn of the 21st century, about 50,000 people were deported a year in this country. Since the turn of the century, we average about 250 to 300,000 deportations a year. And this is where we meet Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. For do you remember when the Department of Homeland Security was created? In the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attack, the government under George W. Bush reorganized the government. It reorganized it to create an infrastructure, they said, that would keep us safe from terrorism. And if you remember that time, if you were alive, you'll remember the palpable fear that it was in this country, this fear of the other, fear of Muslims who found their way across borders, across the Mexican border, across the Canadian border, none of which actually happened, of course, but the fears were real and palpable. And so the Department of Homeland Security was created, this mega omnibus department that would try to keep us safe, and a key part of it was the creation of Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, now called ICE. And the function of ICE wasn't a new function, but it was moved over from another department. It was moved over from the Department of Justice. So immigration enforcement was a issue in the Department of Justice. It was moved over to the Department of Homeland Security, effectively changing the ideology in this country from migration and immigration issues of being an economic issue to being a national security issue. And that switch from an economic issue to a national security issue saw the funding for this organization blossom. Now, Immigrations and Customs Enforcement is the most funded law enforcement agency in the federal government. Let's step back. What do they do? So ICE has three major branches. The first is the Enforcement and Removal Operations, which primarily pursues criminals and terrorists involved in drug trafficking, weapons smuggling, human trafficking, cybercrime, financial crimes, and identity fraud. Interestingly, just a few weeks ago, a group of ICE agents who work for this department wrote a letter to the Secretary of ICE, is actually hampering our ability to do this part of the job. That we can't actually fight drug traffickers and weapons smuggling when all of the money is going to immigration enforcement. Interesting. The third branch of ICE is the Office of the Principal Legal Advisor. It's the smallest division. It employs about 1,400 people that provide legal support to other employees and represent the government in immigration courts. Essentially, what was created in 2003 and what continues to this day is a paramilitary deportation force, a force that acts to break apart communities, to tear apart families who have run afoul of the civil offense that is an immigration violation. They target various segments of the undocumented population for monitoring and deportation. And in fact, until last year, ICE had a quota mandating how many beds in detention centers the agency had to maintain. No other law enforcement agency has a quota of how many beds they needed to maintain, and ICE officers have talked about the push that that quota had to get them to fill it with people. This is the agency that knocks on people's doors and snatches parents from their children. It issues threats to those who have supposedly been deferred, their deportations deferred. It is targeted specifically outspoken immigration activists. And ICE is given a lot of latitude. In fact, ICE can lie about who they are. They can say their officers are police officers, are local police officers when they come to your door. They're instructed to try to enter houses to detain individuals without warrants. They enter houses and workplaces on simply a guess. Are 11 million undocumented people in this country. 11 million. Two-thirds of which have been here in this country for at least a decade. 5% of our workforce is in fact undocumented. The plurality of these undocumented people are from Mexico, and that history with Mexico helps us know why. But recently there's been a rise in Central Americans because of the violence in their nations. These people pay millions of dollars in taxes for services that they are not allowed to receive. And our economy is completely based upon their labor. One sign of this is that right now in California, there are fields of crops that are rotting, unable to be harvested because there is no labor because of the zero tolerance policy of this administration. All of us live in this society. We benefit from their work. It is a part of our economy. And yet we're living in a nation right now that wants these 11 million people gone. Now there is bipartisan support or consensus that our immigration system is broken. In fact, every year there seems to be a new proposal, a new system that hopefully will break this deadlock, that will give conservatives and liberals something they might be able to agree about, because what we can agree about is that it is broken. The problem right now is we have an agency dedicated to terrorizing and breaking apart 11 million people's families. And they're doing so while the rest of the nation is at a standstill about what to do with immigration in the first place. So maybe we should try to figure out what we should do with these 11 million people that are a part of our society before we should maybe figure out what we should do with them and not terrorize them. That maybe we should figure out a consensus that we're not all going to like about immigration reform. And while we do that, maybe we shouldn't tear apart their families even more. Maybe we should free our future in a way. This is why this call to abolish ICE has been ringing out so loudly. It is a call that is asking us, asking the country, to consider taking the teeth out of immigration enforcement while we try to figure out what to do. It is like we were getting mauled at the same time we're debating the existence of the dog. I brought you out of Egypt. I brought you out of Egypt. You won the lottery of responsibility to be in this place. Maybe the question isn't about hospitality, about welcoming people into your house, but restitution for what has happened. Maybe the question for all of us is not to be welcoming, but to remember our liberation is caught up with their liberation. And maybe we shouldn't support an organization so dedicated to destroying lives. Amen.